morning, and welcome back to your Hebrew Nation Morning Show, where Hebrews from all over the world gather to share and listen about the biblical roots of our faith. Sit back with your favorite morning brew and join the conversation. Lines are now open, so call 503-967-3001. 503-967-3001. Nation, His kingdom, His people, and your radio station.
Well, as the digital rooster with laryngitis says, it's good morning from Hebrew Nation Radio. This is the Remnant Road, November 26, 2018, with Mike Clayton, myself, Barry Phillips, and welcome back. Not Cotter, but Al McCarn. Al, it's great to have you back on the show today.
It is great to be back. Thank you, Barry and Mike, for holding down things while I was away for the past month. The shows that you all did were fun to play with and listen to and edit. And you gave me a lot of things to think about, as usual. I just wish I had been part of it, but now I'm back, and let's play ball.
Well, Al, truth be told here that even when you were gone, and we're going to get into the reasoning there and give you a little bit of time, but appreciate you doing the podcast and putting all that up there. It is some work. There is not just, doesn't all happen by accident. No evolutionary monkey gets into the computer system and just does it on their own. It takes some time and effort. So appreciate you doing that, even though you were indisposed for a little while. So you've been in the nation of Texas.
Yes.
Give us an update of what your life has been for the last few weeks.
Okay. Some people might say it was a parallel universe. It was. Yeah. We were in San Antonio. My father-in-law, Chaplain Ray Berry, passed away a month ago, at the age of 88. Now, he was a almost 30-year veteran of the United States Army, retired as a full colonel, which is hard to do if you're a chaplain.
Mm-hmm. Very difficult. That's an amazing rank. Chaplains are not normally known for going up in rank like that.
Well, that's true, but it speaks to the character of the man.
Sure.
Now, he was coherent all the way up to the very end. It's just his body gave out. He'd been feeble for quite a while. And, I learned a lot of things this past month, one of which was approaching the aged. Now, when I first met Ray, he was a year younger than I am now. And he had just retired from the Army. He was vigorous and quite the physical specimen, always active. When they moved back to San Antonio to their house, he was very active in his house, in his garden, and in the community. And, he stayed active as much as he possibly could, even though starting 25, 26 years ago, he began having these chronic health issues that progressively limited his physical abilities. Hmm. And for the last several years, he was wearing a brace on his ankle. It was very hard for him to walk around. For the last couple of years, he was on oxygen. He had a walker, but his mind was still there. And, watching that decline, it's part of life. But particularly as we are gathered as a family, and I remember especially sitting with the pastor who conducted the memorial service for him, and it was my brother-in-law and his son, my wife and I, my mother-in-law, and we were all remembering Ray Berry, his life, his career, and reminded me of the man that I first met. So here's something that I learned. When we approach the aged and we see that they're very slow, sometimes it takes them a while to figure out a thing or to grasp what you're saying to them, that could be because they're hard of hearing, perhaps, or they have these physical limitations. Mm-hmm. But that is a pale shadow of what they were. And if you want to dismiss them or brush them off or try to do something for them that they can do, they just do it slower, you're robbing them of honor.
Mm-hmm. You know, Al, I've seen obituaries here recently. Not that, you know, some people, they get the paper and the first thing they do is go to the obituary page.
Well, a lot of people do that to see if they're there.
Yeah, see if it's been reported that they're dead.
My grandmother used to do that. She said, I get the paper so I can read the obituaries and see if I'm in it.
Yeah. So a lot of times now what I'm seeing, instead of a current picture, the family will post a picture of them in their, maybe we would call it their heyday, you know, their more preferred remembrance of themselves and a more youthful vintage of themselves. And you realize this person that's died in their 80s, their 90s, they were young. They had a life. They were vigorous. You would think, you know, this elderly lady with white hair and frail abilities and so forth, and they put a young picture and you're like, wow, man, she was beautiful. Really, she still is. The person that exists is the one that's on the inside.
That's right.
And all you have to do, Al, to understand the lack of honor in our society is take 1 hour and walk through a nursing home.
Mm-hmm.
And well, it's one of the most shameful, sad, heart-wrenching experiences that you can imagine. And it's why most people never go.
Yeah, Barry, it's not even that. Even as we're talking, Kathy does Meals on Wheels 3 days a week. And, you know, it's a bittersweet for her. Right now, she's in the process that, you know, she comes home and I say, give me the update on the old people. And so she's got nicknames for a lot of them. She has two that she calls Ma and Paul Kettle. And she said, I think I'm about to lose them. They're about to go in a nursing home, and this person fell. And, you know, for a lot of these people, she's one of the only ones that they see, them and maybe the caregiver that comes out, you know. And so she is the height of their day, bringing them that meal, you know, because a lot of times they've just been kind of set to the side. The children don't have much to do with them, with the parents. They're just there. They have no friends. They really don't have anybody to talk to. It's a sad situation.
Yes. And this is where I refer to our friend, Dr. Sukina, and the way he is helping us understand the value of elders, how in native societies, these are the people that receive the most honor, and folks listen to them. Why? Well, they've been through life. Mm-hmm. They've been through everything that we have been through or are about to go through, and they've made good choices and bad choices. And if we just listen to them, they'll be glad to share their experience so that our experience is a little better.
You know, I spent some time at home, and when I say at home, that's a 4.5 hour drive back to the south central part of Virginia, where I was raised, and spent some time with my parents. And, you know, sometimes they will look at you and they will tell you the same story they've told you multiple times as if this is the first time you've heard it. Mm-hmm. And the temptation is to say, Dad, Mom, you told me about that. And I'm just realizing maybe they are saying it to us again, not so much because they don't remember telling us before, but they're rehearsing it in our hearing one more time so that we don't forget it.
Mm, right.
You know, there was a momentary incident at one of the gatherings where I felt that my dad was being dishonored. And it was in the idea of jesting and picking, if you will. But Dad didn't take it that way, and it was very bothersome to him. And for the first time, and I don't remember when, I called someone down and I was ready to take them outside.
Mm.
I mean, I don't, you know, that's not me. That's not, but you're not going to pick on my dad and you're not going to dishonor him. And thankfully, all I had to do was say a word. But if it hadn't stopped, there was not just myself, but there was a room full of us that would have helped someone to understand you're not going to do that.
Mm.
But
right.
When a patriarch has lived and set an example of integrity and righteousness, a prayer walk, you know, I was thinking coming home, I wouldn't be here if this man had not prayed for me. Mm. And the person picking on him would not be here, would not even be alive if my father had not interceded for them.
Mm-hmm.
So we owe our very life to the prayers of this man who didn't even understand all that was going on for us, but he wept, cried, and reached the heavens on our behalf when we weren't even aware of our need. And he is worthy to be stood up and applauded and given first seat and first in line, time, attention, and a hearing ear anytime he wants to speak. And we fail to understand that not only as a society as a whole, guys, but in the Hebrew Roots community in particular, we need to learn what it means to show honor, especially if we disagree with someone. We mm-hmm. shut them off and ridicule them before they ever get started.
Let me talk about that a bit. My father-in-law was a minister of the gospel of Jesus Christ. It was at the age of 10 that he professed his faith in Jesus at the church that his family was attending in Oklahoma. And at a very early age, he felt the call to the ministry. Now, his career progression initially was what you would expect. He went to seminary in Oklahoma. He pastored a church for a short time as he went back and got an advanced degree in divinity at the same seminary, and then understood that his calling to ministry was specifically toward the military. Therefore, not having any military background whatsoever, or in his family any military background, volunteered to become a chaplain in the United States Army in 1957.
Wow.
And then for the next 30 years, well, 29 years and change, served this nation, the United States, in a number of different assignments in the continental United States, in Europe, in Korea, in Vietnam.
I was going to ask, was he in Nam also?
Absolutely. And these are the things. I had the honor of preparing his obituary, which meant I got to go through all his military records to make sure we got the facts straight. You don't think about chaplains being brave and courageous. He had a Bronze Star and he had a Vietnam Cross of Gallantry.
Wow.
And his year in Vietnam was as a brigade chaplain, and he could quite easily have stayed within the realm of his duties in a safe garrison performing the religious services and supervising those beneath him. But he would go out to the combat zones, even in defiance of orders, you know, as in his brigade commander saying, "Chaplain, I can't afford to lose you." But he would go to where the fighting was happening because he did not want those men to die alone. And he didn't want them to die alone without hope of eternal salvation. Now, I'm talking in Christian terms because this is what he understood. And the folks who were remembering about him shared the stories he shared of holding in his arms young men who were dying as they prayed prayers of repentance to accept Jesus Christ as their Savior while the bullets are flying. Okay, so those who tell me on this Hebrew Roots walk that the church got it all wrong, I beg to differ. A man doesn't do things like that for a lie, or if he's all wrong. This is the compassion that moved my father-in-law to his dying day. When he came back, he served in the 70s as the chaplain at Brooke Army Medical Center in San Antonio at Fort Sam Houston. So he saw a lot of sick and injured and dying people there, soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines, and their families. And the normal duties of a chaplain would be, well, go check on these folks, pray with them, see what their needs are, meet them if you can. Well, he would go beyond that, even to the point of staying in someone's bedside, so that they would not die alone. Mm. Now, Barry, you're a pastor, and Mike, you've been a pastor. You know how that is.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And there are numerous times.
My mother-in-law would say he would come home late at night, just all torn up, because he had wept with family members as their loved one passed, mm-hmm. or had been there the only one at someone's bedside. He had a pastor's heart. So it helps me to understand where my sense of honor has been lacking. Because when I first began to understand the applicability of Torah and how things that I had learned in the church were not quite right or not quite complete, though I tried not to be overzealous in communicating this, it was not received well. So there was tension between myself and my father-in-law and between myself and my mother-in-law. Mm-hmm. Now I understand why. The cause that Ray Barry dedicated himself to, serving the living Savior he knew as Jesus Christ, was, in his eyes, threatened by what I was bringing without perfect understanding and, you know, not with perfect love, I might add, though I tried. But things, I think, did come full circle. We were never able to see eye to eye on this. But I did find, when I was cleaning up his office and putting in order all the bookshelves there, some papers that he had printed off from the computer about the time that we left San Antonio 2.5 years ago to move here to North Carolina. And it was the question, what is the Hebrew Roots movement? He had gone to a Christian website, and this is an answer he found, and he printed off. That told me that at the age of 86, seeing that his daughter and his son-in-law and his grandchildren were embarked on this path that he didn't understand, but knowing that they had professed a resounding love of and adherence to the same Savior that he had served all his life, he wanted to find out what this was. And I'll tell you, as I read through that article that he had printed off, there were some things in there not quite right, things that I would disagree with. But the fact that this man cared enough to find out what it was in the only way he could tells me we were a whole lot closer together than we had differences. And that's just with the man himself. I haven't shared yet about my mother-in-law and the blessings that we had ministering to her in the 3 weeks that we were in her house. So when I talk about the honor, when we talk about honor and the lack thereof in the Hebrew Roots community, well, here it is. If we're just remembering that we have forgotten our Jewish roots. Guys, let's not forget the Christian roots either. We need both.
You know, Al, when we came out, many of us came out of whatever place we came from with an angst against our pastors and a chip on our shoulder. And we came out promoting, my preacher lied to me. My pastor lied to me. Well, they were more than likely, they were giving to us what they understood to be true. Now, we may have disagreed with the doctrine, but the man or the woman in the pulpit, if that were the case, they were sincere in what they were preaching. It was what they were taught. It's what we were taught. Now we may disagree, but we can't hold a personal grudge against these individuals. What that has promoted then is a resistance of pastoral effect and leadership mm-hmm. within the Hebrew Roots community. We overgrandize the role of teacher, those who give us knowledge, and we've ended up glorifying knowledge. But because we lack pastoral leadership, we don't understand relationship. So if there's to be the right balancing of our community and a right walk determined, we have to see not the elimination of teachers, we need them, but we need to see a rising up of pastors and people who are over being angry at pastors and allow them to come forward in our community and do their work of building relationship and community harmony. And that's a role that teachers are just not equipped to do. So we can't expect our teachers to shift gears. We need a different gifting to rise up. And if we resist them out of our previous angst, it's to our own harm and detriment.
That's right.
Yeah. Barry, I'm reminded again about the statement that's, I don't know where it came from, but said in ancient Israel, there were many teachers, but few shepherds. And there's two sides of this thing. Number one is there's few shepherds. I've seen that. And Jeremiah chapter 23, speaking of that, what is referred to as the greater Exodus, speaks of, I will raise up shepherds after my own heart. And so at this point in time, I don't see those shepherds. One of the other side of the coin, though, is that there is a growing desire for shepherds. But as you said, many people have been hurt through the years. And so just the very fact of a shepherd, you know, entering in to something, people, you know, kind of put their hands up and resist. But I think we do see groups now that are seeing we must have shepherds if we're going to go forward.
That's the truth. And as we close out this segment, let me just tell you, my father-in-law, Ray Barry, was a shepherd to his dying day. You know, after he left the Army, he became a Protestant pastor for a retirement village in San Antonio, ministering to the elderly. And after he left that calling, he and his wife continued to be very, very active in their church, teaching and Meals on Wheels, as you mentioned, Mike, they did that, visiting shut-ins, continuing to do those pastoral things, even though they didn't have to. They could have just sat back and enjoyed their retirement years.
Yeah.
I mean, up to the very end, when in the last few weeks he was not able to do it, he was still trying to care for others. Even in the stores where they visited, people knew them, loved them. They give them flowers because they kept being nice to them and treating them with dignity and honor, so that perhaps they might have an understanding of our Creator.
A shining city on a hill, Yerushalayim, we're longing for you, Yerushalayim, we know where we belong, Yerushalayim, we're coming back home.
Well, welcome back home, or at least on the road to home, the remnant road to home for this November 26, 2018. This is Al McCarn along with Mike Clayton and Barry Phillips. And guys, I'm glad to be back home, at least what is home now, Charlotte, North Carolina. I understand Hanoch is not home because he just landed where I was.
Yes, yes. He is in the nation of Texas, San Antonio, working on some video right now. I just got the email. And so he'll be in San Antonio for a couple more days, then flying out. And I pick him up in Atlanta, Georgia. We'll be heading to Jasper on Shabbat. Let's see, what's the schedule? He wants to go up to Cherokee, possibly. So we're going to probably take him up there. Friday night, we'll go down to Jasper. He'll be speaking Saturday at Jasper, Georgia House of Scripture. And then Sunday in Somerville, South Carolina. The schedule has been changed a little bit from he was going to be at Columbia, Gates to Zion, on Tuesday night, but now it's going to be Monday night, because I guess there's going to be a candle lighting somewhere in the area for Hanukkah. Yeah, got too many Hanukkahs for Hanukkah. That's going to be Tuesday, and then the rest is history.
So it will be a Hanukkah. Just wondered. I mean, on the break, you all were trying to take Christmas songs and turn them into Hanukkah songs, so I'm just chiming in.
Hey, you know, what's wrong with Grandma got run over by a camel?
It just ain't right.
Just ain't right. Neither are we.
Apparently so. Hey, Mike, as long as we're talking about Hanok, I'm sure he would appreciate that we mention his website. Would you do the honor?
Yeah, kolyehuda.com. That's kolyehuda.com. And people can go and find his itinerary. Everything's going on. He'll be heading back to, he's still got a little bit of time here, and then he heads back to Israel. So he's actually taking time away from being in Israel during Hanukkah, which, I mean, that's just, talk about not being right. That's it right there. Being in Israel during Hanukkah is an amazing, amazing time. And we're actually going to spend the next hour speaking about that. But for now, Al, let's go back to your experiences, what you've gone through, and showing honor to your father-in-law.
Well, my parents-in-law and people in general, I haven't talked about my mother-in-law, Ruth, but let me tell you about her. First of all, ministering to her for 3 weeks was a tremendous blessing, because we got there just 2 days after Ray had passed. And we had some extended family dynamics here, because the ones who've been doing the best they could to care for both of them were my brother-in-law, John, and his wife, Sonia. Well, they were also caring for Sonia's sister, who passed away from cancer just week before last. And they had to tend to her in her last days. So we arrived at the very perfect moment to help Ruth deal with losing her best friend of 40 years and helping her pick up the pieces and get ready to move on. Now, this is the second time she's been widowed. Her first husband was an Air Force pilot who was shot down over Vietnam in 1968.
Mm.
And so she raised two sons as a single mother. And when she met Ray, it was within a year after his first wife passed away, he lost her to cancer. So here we have these two widowers that met in church in Sunday school, and they blended their families, with she bringing in two sons who were, I think they were like 17 and 19 at the time. And Charlene, my wife, had just turned 13. So that was an interesting process, putting those two families together. Mm-hmm. But, even going back before then, when she was an infant of 6 months old, her father and mother loaded all the kids into the car in the middle of Kansas, in the midst of the Dust Bowl of the Great Depression, and drove northwest and ended up in Washington State. They saw that there was nothing for them there, that people in that region, for some strange reason, there was a large percentage of infant and childhood mortality. I don't recall the whole story, but her father decided that he would reach out and find something better so that his children would have a better chance to live. Guess what they did? They all lived to their 80s. Wow. Ruth is the last of that generation. And they were all good, solid Christian folk. So no wonder that Ruth and Ray met as widowers in church, because that was their lives.
Yeah, that was kind of the only thing they were doing. I understand that. I mean, Kathy's mom and dad, that was their whole life. Everything revolved. And we live in a society today that doesn't really understand that.
Right.
Doesn't have that concept that everything that you did revolved around the church. It was Sunday morning. It was Sunday night. It was Wednesday night. It was the vacation Bible school. It was all those different things.
Yeah. So, and she's still ministering, even then, when she's a single mom, she's teaching Sunday school, and she's helping with functions in the church, the community that is the church. She was a speaker and a teacher, and she led Bible studies for women, and, doing quite a good work of outreach to folks who otherwise would not have had any reason to connect with their creator. Certainly heard the story of Jesus, as she calls him, Yeshua, as we call him. But what we what we saw when we got there last month was a woman who was just completely at her wit's end, utterly exhausted, because she had given her everything caring for Ray in his last days. Mm. And each day we would do something, whether it was going through the papers. Char was good at that, going through the papers and deciding, okay, this you need to do something with, these we can toss, calling people, taking her to appointments. I straightened up that office with a bookshelf that had not had any attention for 20 years and found some things that needed some attention. We took her to Fort Sam Houston to the casualty assistance office, and we sat down with the nice lady there who has been through this a time or two for the last 25 years, helping spouses of service people who have passed and helping them walk through the procedures. You know, when people die, there's so much to be done.
Oh, it's amazing the amount of paperwork and everything that it takes.
Absolutely. So we got that done. We were able to get her set up with an appointment with the Veterans Administration. I was able to get her bank account, her bank books in order. And every day something. Oh, yes. And planning the memorial service and then the final military honors for my father-in-law. Mm-hmm. Once all of every day something got accomplished, even if it was just a little bit of, well, we've got this person on the phone and we have set this appointment. So every day I was able to see Ruth's mood lighten a little bit. I was able to see her focus a little better. She was able to sleep a little better. And the woman we left a week ago when we departed was much, much better off than the woman we found. There's still so much more to do, but now she's got her feet on the ground and she will soon be back into being the contributing member of her community that she has been all of her 80 something years. That in itself was a tremendous blessing and an honor, and reminded me again, there's so much more that brings us together and unites us than the things that divide us.
Well, you know, Al, as you've been talking this whole program, I'm thinking about, you use terminology that we most of us don't use anymore, and you're talking about a man who was preaching the gospel as he knew it. And there would be people, probably not listening to us today, but there would be people in the Roots community that would be just, their blood pressure going up and, blood spurting from their eyes because of, giving honor to somebody that was not teaching the Torah. I would much rather be standing, in that final day of judgment. I would much rather be standing behind somebody like Ray in line than I would somebody that's been arguing over the shape of the earth.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Well, the question is, what's really important, and what's important to the heart of our Heavenly Father?
Yeah.
Because he's the one we're supposed to honor ultimately. And now, I recall several years ago when Eddie Chumney's parents were killed.
Yes.
And hearing, hearing the message he delivered on their behalf, how they kept the heart of the Torah, love God, love others, do justice, show mercy, walk humbly with your God, that sort of thing. My father-in-law and my mother-in-law have done that, even though we have tremendous differences and we don't get along all the time. They are still walking out the covenant in the best way they know how.
Yeah.
Let me tell you something else. As I'm going through my father-in-law's books and discovering some gems in there.
Oh, that must have been an experience.
Yeah, I appropriated a few.
Sure.
I came across one that I haven't read yet, and I'm holding it now in my hand. The Case for Christ, A Journalist's Personal Investigation of the Evidence for Jesus by Lee Strobel.
Mm-hmm. I saw the movie.
Oh, yeah. Well, I hadn't seen the movie yet, but I'm familiar with Lee's testimony. A skeptic who wanted to know what's this all about and set about trying to disprove the Bible and ended up being an ardent follower of Yeshua HaMashiach, Jesus Christ, and an apologist here you know, writing books. He's got a whole ministry, done movies to say, this is what I found. This is what I believe. And I realized, you know, maybe I need a refresher course here. So I'm going to read this book in the next few weeks. Another thing I found, a nice selection of C.S. Lewis. And the other one that I brought back with me is called The Case for Christianity. Now, this slim volume is the series of lectures he gave on the radio for the BBC in the 1940s. And eventually, that became Mere Christianity, a book that I have read multiple times and impacted me as a young man. Now, I've also read Lewis's testimony of how he came from intellectual skepticism, atheism, all the way to profession of faith in Jesus Christ, and a member in good standing of the Anglican Church, and one of the intellectual giants of Christianity of the 20th century, or perhaps of the last several centuries. Now, there's another man who influenced me a great deal when I was young. In fact, I heard him speak several times when I was in high school and college, and that was Josh McDowell.
Oh,
and
yeah.
He too, came from...
The man's a verdict.
That's right. And more than a carpenter, and the resurrection factor. And I heard him deliver these messages. I read those books and understood his testimony as another who was a skeptic seeking to disprove the Bible. And he's as good or better a researcher than Lee Strobel, and as fine an intellect as C.S. Lewis. And he came to the conclusion that Jesus of Nazareth, and I know, Mike, we've had a conversation of Jesus of Nazareth. Okay. But the one that I grew up knowing as Jesus Christ of Nazareth, that he was either a liar, he was a lunatic, or he was the Lord. That's the only possibility you can have. Lewis came to the same conclusion. And you know what? The first century disciples had that same conclusion as well. And the greatest evidence, I think, that we have is that they went to their deaths proclaiming this living Messiah who is God become human. So these are the Christian roots I'm talking about that we tend to have forgotten. And I've given you the testimonies of three men. Now, what does Torah say? Confirm a matter on two or three witnesses. Well, C.S. Lewis, Lee Strobel, and Josh McDowell are just three of the witnesses who confirm this matter in my heart. I could add my testimony as well. So if you want to say that Christianity is all a lie, that the New Testament is bogus, that Jesus or Yeshua is not who he claimed to be, well, you're going to have to disprove some heavy hitters here and say that they were absolutely ludicrous or insane or didn't know what they were talking about.
Yeah. Al, it was a number of years ago. You were there at the Congress, the first B'nai Yosef Congress in REL. And I coined a phrase at that time that said, in looking toward the horizon, never forget the shoulders that you're standing on. What you're doing today is you're proclaiming to people the shoulders in which we stand on. The tragedy of the generation is that many people do not even know whose shoulders they are standing on. They've never heard of many of the people that you're talking about. That is a tragedy.
Yes, it is. Now, the good thing that's been happening in this generation is we are recognizing at last the Jewish shoulders that we've been standing on.
Exactly.
And learning some of those missing pieces which make this gospel of redemption so incredibly powerful, so compelling, make it what it is. But if we throw out the Christian part of it, of the living divine Messiah, then we throw out half the message, the one that gives it its power, as the Hebraic part that comes from the Jewish side gives it its structure so that power can be applied. Yeah, that's kind of what I've been thinking ever since I've been reading Paul with new eyes for the last 15 years.
Yeah, yeah. It is amazing. It's really amazing. You know, I've had the opportunity a number of times to go through a library of someone that had passed away. I have a couple of books. I've got a couple of Bibles that are just, you know, dear references. I've got the second volume of a Matthew Henry commentary that's copyrighted back in the 1800s. To go through books that were written in the early 1900s is, you know, I read a number of them. These people, the title of the book had much more depth than most books do that are being written today. You had to just stop and say, now, what is that title about? What are they trying to say here? You know, it brought forth thought processes. Most of what is being written today is so shallow that a lot of it's just not even worth reading, in my opinion.
Well, I remember when Laura and I first got married, we were involved in an internship program in preparation for ministry. We were assigned somewhere around 5 to 7 books a month that we had to read. And somewhere in the allotment, we were given one that Al mentioned a little while ago, C.S. Lewis's Mere Christianity. Not a very large book, but man, I tell you, I got lost in that book so easy. It was so far over my head at that time. I just stumbled through it. Now I'm being challenged to go back and see if I can find a copy of that, because I think it got left in a move somewhere, and reread that. But Mike, it's not just the writings of books. If you were to go back and read some of the letters that were written from the battlefield, say, of the American Revolution, sure, or the Americans, the war between the states, better known here as the War of the Northern Invasion, the letters sent home from the average soldier requires such a stop and ponder what that sentence just said before you go on to the next one effort. It would be difficult for us just to casually read stuff. We have been dumbed down. And that's not a conspiracy theory about American education. We have just been dumbed down from writing letters and expressing thought and understanding of the heart and the mind to basically we pick up a digital device in our hands and we send initials to people and speak in very short digital-esque or digital ease. And
emojis.
You know, we have dumbed down our minds and our understandings. No wonder we are so easily led astray. But what you're referencing in the content, very often we are hearing in sermons and songs and in books a super promotion of super grace. And the way it's being presented most often in these days is that grace is not a divine empowerment to live righteously and do rightly, but a freedom from accountability. And the chasm between those two concepts is enormous. So we are falling horrendously on one side and failing horrendously on the other.
That we are, because it's a whole lot easier for an enemy to succeed if the opponents are divided and distracted and not quite able to understand what's going on.
So with 2 minutes, guys, what's the answer?
Well, I think Rav Shaul, the Apostle Paul, gave a pretty good answer, which in the King James says, study to show thyself approved. Okay. You know, while we are busily learning things, let's learn real things. It requires digging into the scriptures. It requires, I would say, bypass the commentaries and go straight to the scriptures themselves. And then look at the commentaries after you have an understanding of the scriptures.
Yeah, and not be distracted. Okay, I had an email just this weekend. Somebody had brought up this thing of this guy that wrote regarding the Temple Mount. It's not the Temple Mount, but it was in the city of David. And it was like, in the end, what is the purpose of that argument? I strongly disagree with this concept and with this book. I think it's a faulty foundation to begin with. But in the end, what does if we found out that the Temple Mount was in a different spot than it is, what difference is that going to make in how I live my life today?
Right.
If I found out that the earth really was flat, what difference is that going to make in my life today? Right. I'm not going to drive any different. I'm a Yisrael high.
Good morning, and welcome back to your Hebrew Nation Morning Show, where Hebrews from all over the world gather to share and listen about the biblical roots of our faith. Sit back with your favorite morning brew and join the conversation. Lines are now open, so call 503-967-3001. 503-967-3001. Hebrew Nation, His Kingdom, His People, and your radio station.
Welcome back to the Remnant Road with the following: Harry Phillips, Al Karn, Mike Clayton, Hanok Young's not here. And there you have it.
There we are.
But he's here in spirit.
Well, I don't know about that. That's kind of freaky to me.
All right. Hey, guys, I think I know where he's going for lunch today in San Antonio.
Oh.
Yeah. And, you know, he's not going to get out of that town without going at least twice to Green Vegetarian Cuisine.
Yeah, I've heard about that. Well, I guess that's okay.
Yeah. And that, by the way, is our fault, because we took him there the first time.
You took him there the first time? So it's up to you. It's all yours now.
That's right. That's okay.
Well, you know, guys, we didn't plan, literally, we didn't plan a minute of this show today.
We could tell.
Came into it, knowing that here you are coming back off of a very difficult time for you and Shar. And, we want to give you guys an opportunity there. And it's just really progressed into something that next week we have a guest that will be on. So we thought, let's talk a little bit about Hanukkah, because that's coming up. Is it the night of the 2nd that it begins, Al?
Yes, according to the calendar that most all of the Jewish world and a huge chunk of the Hebraic world follow, it's December 2nd, that night, all the way through the sundown on the 10th.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting when you say calendar there. Even though people have different calendars that they go by, when it comes to Hanukkah, most everybody just goes ahead and uses the Hillel calendar.
Now, why is that?
I don't know. It's just kind of funny. You know, people don't, I guess there are some, but, well, maybe we won't want to go too far down that road, because that road gets a little bumpy. But there is a battle that goes on every year with people regarding this time. First of all, Hanukkah is not a Christmas alternative.
What?
Yeah. Barry, tell Laura to put the Hanukkah bush back up, okay? Even though it's decorated with blue and white ornaments, it shouldn't be used.
Well, we have a great room, and it is blue. Thanksgiving is over. The fall decor is now out of sight, and the area is blue, and there will be it will be blue for a while. Mm-hmm. And it's that's fine. Mm-hmm. Anyone that comes in, that won't have any misunderstanding of where we're at.
Everybody will know exactly what you're doing. And I just had a conversation with my neighbor the other day. He had the Thanksgiving stuff in his yard, and he said, yep, day after Thanksgiving, that's coming down, putting up Christmas. And he looked at me and says, you probably don't do Christmas, do you? I said, no, Hanukkah. He said, well, there's somebody around the corner that's got one of those, what's that light thing that goes in the window? And I said, oh, yeah. So I'm going to be looking for that. But first of all, this is not an alternative to Christmas, though it is become that in some circles. Let's don't look at it as such. Hanukkah is totally separate this year from the time of Christmas. But here's an interesting statement for you, Al. Do you know that if it was not for Hanukkah, there would be no Christmas?
Hey, you are absolutely right about that. Now, do you want to unpack that statement a little bit, or shall I?
Well, I mean, I could. Go ahead, Al. Go ahead and do that for me. I want to see how you unpack it. I'd probably unpack it a little different.
Okay. Well, let me start with the lighthearted observation that every one of the Jewish holidays, as I grew up learning to call them, as we know, Feast of the Lord, except for Hanukkah and Purim, which really are Jewish holidays, every one of them can be encapsulated with this. They tried to kill us. God saved us. Let's eat.
Right.
Even Yom Kippur, what do you do after the fast is over? There you go. So Hanukkah embodies that so well. Because here we have Judea in the year 168 BCE. And it is not independent. It is a political football between the powerful Greekish kingdoms of the Ptolemies in Egypt and the Seleucids in Syria. And it goes back and forth until the Syrian Greeks gain control over it. And the emperor, Antiochus IV, decides that, the Romans have come and they backed his Egyptian enemies to the point that he can't fight against them anymore. So he throws an imperial temper tantrum and the Jews get the worst of it. Did I describe that well enough?
You did pretty good. I'm okay with it.
All right. So his imperial temper tantrum says, you Jews, don't do any more of the Torah studies. Don't circumcise your children. Quit celebrating these feasts that you've been celebrating. Don't do any more of that. I want you to worship my gods. Oh, your temple. Yeah, I'm appropriating that. I'm going to put a statue of my god Zeus in there, and I'm going to start sacrificing things to him. And some of the things we sacrifice include pigs. So I want y'all to eat of this sacrifice and rejoice with me as I rejoice in honor of my god. Well, there were some Jews who went along with it, and there were some Jews who didn't. And this is where we get to the Maccabees, because there was a priest named Matthew. I hope I got that one right, Matthew, because it was his son, Judah Maccabee, who led the rebellion. But he's an old priest, and he's in the city of Modi'in. We know someone who lives in Modi'in.
It's true.
Hanok Young lives there. And the Greek authorities with soldiers came around and they said, hey, we're going to set up this altar. We're going to have y'all eat some pig and we're going to have a barbecue in honor of our God. They said it with a Greek accent. And this family priest said, no, we're not going to do it. So they rose up and slew the Greek authorities and rallied the town, which ended up rallying the nation, which started a war against the oppression and ended up 3 years later liberating the temple. Didn't completely liberate all the land or all of Judea, but it did liberate the temple. So they began to rededicate the temple of the Lord in Jerusalem and reinstitute the statutes that had been handed down from Moses through the Torah. So when you say, Mike, that if there'd been no Hanukkah, there'd be no Christmas, there was a need for a temple of the Lord to be present in the city of the Lord in Jerusalem. Because as the prophet said, the Lord whom you seek will suddenly come into his temple.
Mm-hmm.
If there'd been no temple for him to suddenly come into, he wouldn't have been the Lord, I suppose. But this was an existential threat to Judaism. And if it's an existential threat to Judaism, that means it is a threat to the very existence of the one remnant of people on the face of the planet who are still honoring the Torah and the God of the Torah and doing their best, however imperfectly, to keep it. Because they've learned hard lessons in the previous centuries through war, destruction, exile, all kinds of nasty stuff. And now these Greeks come and they want to wipe them out as well. If the Maccabees had not stood up and fought so long and so hard at such great cost to win back what God had given them and win back the city that he had placed his name, then the conditions in which our Messiah was born a century and a half later would not have been established. And it would be a very, very different story. Now, mind you, God would find a way, I'm sure. But this is the way it has worked out in history. So, Mike, when you say there would be no Christmas if there were no Hanukkah, you are absolutely right. And when in the previous segment we were talking about the shoulders we stand on, you know, some of those Jewish shoulders we've been standing on are the broad shoulders of Judah Maccabee and his brothers.
You know, Al, when you mentioned something other there about they're being compelled to worship the Greek gods, etc. It brought to mind that in Yeshua's day, the remembrance of that conflict, you say it was a century between the American mindset is not that far removed from the wars of our country 100 years ago. 100 years ago, we were dealing with World War I. You know, my grandfather fought in World War I, and he's not been dead that long. I have fond memories of him, and my children have memories of him. That era is not that far. It still has some passion left in our society. So in the time of Yeshua, that passion was still there, especially with the angst that the Roman oppressors were now there in place of the Greek oppressors. And it was like deja vu all over again. Mm-hmm. So in the book of Acts, when we read about the Hellenists that were being overlooked, the widows that were being overlooked in the daily ministration of food, the Hellenists were those that were Greek in the orientation and culture. They had come to Messiah, but from a completely different background. There was still some of that angst, perhaps, there, that they were among those that yielded to the Greeks during that time of conflict. So they were, perhaps, were they not looked on as traitors or sellouts or in some other negative fashion?
Well, Barry, even if it weren't to that extent, there's this well-documented division in the Jewish world between the strict Hebraic Jewish Jews of Jerusalem in particular, and the Pharisees were the great example thereof, and the more Hellenized, we might even say secularized, Jews elsewhere in the country and also spread around the world.
Right.
Right. So
similar to the divide between American Jews and Israeli Jews.
Well, yes. But when you consider the way to look at the scriptures, the Pharisees were looking at it as, and those like them, that I don't know, do we call them traditionalists? They were saying it's got to be entirely in Hebrew or Aramaic, and if you're going to have any learning at all, you need to come to the synagogue and learn from us. Whereas most of the Jewish world is not in Judea or Galilee. Most of the Jewish world is in Alexandria, Egypt, or spread out across the Mediterranean, or way to the east in what is now Iran. I mean, you see them gathered in Acts 2. It lists the places, the countries where they're gathered. And right. They're not speaking Aramaic and Hebrew. They're speaking Greek. That's the language of business. They're speaking Latin, the language of government. They're speaking probably Arabic, or wherever they live, they're speaking that language. And if they are studying the scriptures, they're not doing it in Hebrew. They're doing it in Greek. That's why there's Septuagint.
So that's the significance of when they began to speak in other languages, the significance of the statement, we hear the wonderful works of Elohim in our own language, as if Hebrew is not their own language. It's some other national dialect.
Yeah, just like we are today. Yeah, I mean,
now that makes sense.
Yeah, we go to Israel and we see the miracle of the rebirth of the Hebrew language. But Barry, you and I study the scriptures in English because we don't understand Hebrew. And we have done some language studies. We've done some word studies. We can pick things out on our own. But the vast amount of learning that I have done has been in English. And that's the same way it would have been 2,000 years ago, only in Greek. And so when the Acts 6, it talks about the Hellenized Jews, is that these were people who were just as much ardent followers of Yahweh and his Torah and his Messiah But they didn't speak Aramaic as their native language or Hebrew as their native language. They spoke Greek, and their mindset, their worldview was through a Greek lens. And they were considered lesser in status.
So, Al, this would be very similar to someone, well, Hanok, let's use him since he can't defend himself today. He grew up in the Bronx in New York. He did not grow up with speaking Hebrew. He did not even grow up in a real observant home. They went to synagogue occasionally, you know, the festivals and things like that. He went through Hebrew school. He said, he's very open with that, that a person that says that they grew up in America and went through Hebrew school, that's equivalent to a kindergarten education. So just because somebody says that they went to Hebrew school doesn't mean they know anything at all. They may know the alphabet a little bit better than some other person. So it was not until, you know, later on in his life that he began to really study and learn Hebrew. But still to this day, you know, English is his native language, to the best of my knowledge. And so, you know, anytime you learn another language, even for us to look at Hebrew, to study Hebrew, we're going to study Hebrew with the basis of our English mindset as our original language.
So he is interpreting as he speaks, determining, okay, in English it is said this way, and so by interpretation it is said another way in Hebrew. He's not interpreting, but translating as he goes. You really adopt the language when you begin to contemplate and think in the other language.
And now he does that because he's living in Israel, and so he's able to think in and adopt that language. But, you know, there still would be times that he would have to do the same, that same thing. We have a son in South Korea. We have a daughter-in-law. You know, we have a grandson in South Korea. That's going to be an interesting one because he's learning both South Korean and English at the same time. So, you know, which one is going to become dominant in his life? I don't know. That's yet to be seen.
Probably so, since he's in Korea, I would think.
Yeah, in Korea because his, you know, his grandparents there are speaking Korean. So, yeah, this whole thing, you know, no matter how far along we think we've come, we still have that mindset, that Greek mindset. And this is what causes a lot of arguments. I want to go back to this original statement of troublemaking that I began with, Al, regarding Christmas. That, you know, the argument has been about, you know, should we celebrate Hanukkah or not? Well, the 8 days, this is just a legend. There's a T-shirt out right now that says, imagine if your cell phone was at 10% but lasted 8 days. Now you understand Hanukkah. Do I believe that the oil lasted for 8 days, or that this is just a legend that's passed down? I'm not going to say. Do I attribute all these things with the dreidel and all this to Hanukkah? I'm not going to say. I'm going to leave that up to an individual. What I'm going to say is this, that if it were not for Judas Maccabees, for those men, and I've stood, Barry, you were with me, at Malay Lavana when we had lunch, and we were looking out at the first battlefield of Hanukkah. We were looking out in those curves down there. That's where it began.
Yeah.
It's an amazing place to stand there and to consider what happened there. To go to Modi'in and consider the men and women that were willing to give their lives. If it wasn't for them, the desires of Antiochus Epiphanes, which would have come to pass, and those desires were very simple, to rid the world of every Jew, which means there would not have been a young woman named Miriam in the Galilee somewhere, for the Ruach HaKodesh, the Holy Spirit, to come upon, so there would be no Messiah. His other desire was to rid the world of that terrible document called the Torah. If it were not for the Maccabees, there would be nothing for us to be restored to today. There would be no Hebrew Roots movement. There would be no Messianics. There would be none of this would even be, because it would have all been extinct over 2,000 years ago. So for me, do I celebrate Hanukkah? Yes, I do. I don't celebrate it the way that most people do. You guys have heard me say this. For me, Hanukkah is God's Veterans Day.
That's a great way to put it, Mike. When the writer of Hebrews wrote in chapter 11, mm-hmm. that hall of faith,
mm-hmm.
and we recognize the names of Abraham and Sarah and the judges like Gideon and Jephthah, we recognize those names. Those he doesn't name are these saints, and I call them that purposefully, who laid down their lives during that War of the Maccabees and afterwards to preserve the way of the Lord as best they understood it. And they deserve our honor.
Al, you were talking earlier about not just fail to remember our Jewish roots, but also not to fail to remember our Christian roots. Let me get that out finally. So at Hanukkah, while we celebrate the remembrance of the Maccabees, those that have stood and endured the pogroms, the expulsions, the inquisitions, etc., over the years to retain Jewish culture, it might, it may be a little more difficult to do so, but alongside, let us also remember that there were some Christian giants who endured and persevered a right understanding of Messiah through the years. Yes, there were a lot of failures in that, but there were a lot of successes. And we stand not on a single set of shoulders, but there are multiple sets of shoulders underneath us that we have been built on. We need to celebrate all of our heroes. And I know...
You know that there's music right there.
Welcome back to the last segment of today's Remnant Row with Alma Carmike Clayton, myself, Barry Phillips. We're delighted to have you along. And what I was trying to state is we were interrupted by the music. I'm thinking of the people that are unsung, unknown heroes to us that were praying years ago, generations even ago, for revival in our country, for a furtherance of the message, for an outpouring of the Ruach HaKodesh. And they would have prayed in the name of Jesus. They would have used Christian terms, etc. But their prayers went largely unanswered in their day, only to find fruition in the last couple decades about a movement that they may not have even understood themselves. As a pastor, years ago, our church was praying for revival. We prayed frequently, weekly, multiple times during the week, and for hours we met and we prayed for revival. We had in our mind a Brandsville-style outpouring where people would come from multiple countries and have to be literally picked up and carried out of the building, still under the power of his presence. That was our expectation. That was what was in our mind when we were crying out. But we were crying out for deliverance and for power and et cetera. And one time in that prayer setting, I heard the Father's voice say to me, son, I'm going to give you the revival you've been praying for, but it's going to come in a means by so that most who have cried out for it will reject it because it will, they will be offended by it. The revival that we were praying for is the life that we're now living. It was a return to the Torah, a restoration of his commands in our lives, revival of our Hebraic root. And he was right. Most of those that were crying out for this revival rejected it because it was offensive to them. It was a device or a division between what they held passionately to and a rejection of what he was leading them to. But nevertheless, those prayers were effective. I wonder how many grandmothers, grandfathers, and their grandparents were crying out for an outpouring, and we're now seeing it in our day, but it's unrecognizable because it doesn't fit the format that most people would expect it. Nevertheless, they're heroes, and they will be honored for what they prayed.
Barry, I recall a few years ago being in Oklahoma City at a conference and hearing a similar thing, because we've been crying out for revival. And let's see, who was this? It was the Heartland Apostolic Prayer Network. That was the conference. We've been crying out for revival for years and years. Now, a Hispanic pastor got up, and he said, you know that revival that you've been praying for? It's been happening, but those who are experiencing it speak Spanish. That's why you haven't recognized it. How about that? And see, he was speaking exactly what the Father was saying to you. So, okay, within the realms of evangelical Christianity, yeah, what we're not getting, what we didn't understand is that when the Lord is moving upon his people, they don't all speak English. And the people who are moving into this new wave, I don't know what you call it, the new move of the Spirit, a lot of them have roots in Puerto Rico, Mexico, Central America, you know, and the Latin communities of the United States, where English and Spanish are equally spoken, and their expressions of this relationship with the living God are a whole lot different than the white Southern Baptists I grew up with. So we're uncomfortable with it. And now here we come along with something that looks Jewish. Imagine how uncomfortable everybody is with that. Nevertheless, what you said, Barry, is absolutely right, because all of that groundwork that was laid in prayer and in actions is what opened the ways for the Spirit to move and bring us to where we are now. And Micah, you were going to say something else about Hebrews 11 and bring this together. So why don't you take us there?
Well, you know, you alluded to the scriptures, and I just wanted to read them because I think it speaks so loudly about where we are today. Starting in verse 32, it says, what more should I say? There isn't time to tell about Gideon, Barak, Shimshon, Yiftach, David, Shemuel, and the prophets, who through trusting conquered kingdoms, worked righteousness, received what was promised, shut the mouths of lions, quenched the power of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, had their weaknesses turned to strength, grew mighty in battle, and routed foreign armies. Women received back their dead resurrected. Other people were stretched on the rack and beaten to death, refusing to be ransomed so that they would gain a better resurrection. Others underwent the trials of being mocked and whipped and chained and imprisoned. They were stoned, sawn in two, murdered by the sword. They went about clothed in sheepskin and goatskins, destitute, persecuted, mistreated, wandering about in deserts and mountains, living in caves and holes in the ground. The world was not worthy of them. All of these had their merit attested because of their trusting. Nevertheless, they did not receive what had been promised, because Elohim had planned something better that would involve us, so that only with us would they be brought to the goal. Amazing words of a people that have stood in the face of things that we cannot even consider today. And it says the world was not worthy of them. In these verses, I see the Maccabees. In these verses, I see all of those people who have gone before us. You talk about we were talking about the C.S. Lewis's, the Josh McDowell's, and these various people that were standing for faith as they knew it. We see rabbinic leaders, Jewish leaders today that were standing for the faith that they knew. I'm thinking about the rabbi that Hanok studied under, Rav Kahana, Mir Kahana. These people. And so for Hanukkah, as I have said, you know, we try to do this as God's Veterans Day. During Hanukkah, I will read the chapter of Hebrews 11. Another thing, a tradition of our home is to sit and talk about those that have gone before us. People who have been instrumental in our lives. My grandmother, dear friend John Faust, various ones that were men and women that shaped me. Some even before I had a clue about anything having to do with anything, really. But before I was walking any kind of life of faith, some of these people were shaping me. And so Hanukkah is a time for me to consider them and to give honor to them, because I understand that, you know, this verse that says, because Elohim had planned something better that would involve us, so that only with us would they be brought to the goal. It's the chapter goes on in chapter 12, and it talks about keep running with endurance the contest that is set before us. I've heard that preached many times, that it is a marathon, but I strongly, strongly disagree with it. A marathon is a race in which you run by yourself. And you, if you happen to win, if you win, you stand with the trophy alone. But a relay race, one that has multiple laps, is a race that at the end, the team holds the trophy together. That is Hanukkah to me.
That's why the writer of Hebrews starts in chapter 12 about the great cloud of witnesses. They're expecting us to pick up the baton and do our part. Because if we don't, their part is invalidated somehow.
Al, if you would allow me to kind of indulge a little bit of time here, there's a story that I've told numerous times. I've done this in Israel with the group there when I was working with Hayavel. I've done this all over. I love to do this with youth. I was not an athlete in any shape, in any form, in growing up. That was not my thing. So athletics is not something that was ever really a part of my life. Running is something I never really understood, why someone would run and nothing is chasing me. So, you know, this is totally out of my league. But when I understood this as that it's talking about a relay race, I began to see this, and someone explained to me about a relay race. And a relay race is this, that you have the different laps, of course, and you have the different runners. But maybe the most important person in the relay race is the coach, because the coach understands his team of runners better than they understand themselves. And I'm told that a coach will put a good runner on the first lap. A man or woman that he knows has the ability to give them a good lead, to give them the moral high ground of being out there in front as they enter into, you know, through that first lap. But then he will take his weaker runners and will put them in the second lap and in the third lap. Runners that have been known to, you know, they just don't have it in them, the speed. They occasionally will drop a baton or could even stumble. But then he'll take his fastest, his strongest runner, a person that the coach knows this person has within him something that he may not even know of himself or herself. And the coach will put that person in the fourth lap. so that no matter what the situation looks like, whether a baton has been dropped or someone has stumbled and they're in the last place and it's hopeless, he knows. That coach knows that this person has it within themselves to pick up, to take the lead and to win. But he wins for the team. I told this story to to a group of people a number of years ago, and someone walked up to me and said, "Mike, you have just described our son." Said our son has a special needs. He competes in the Special Olympics and he's a racer. He's a marathon or a relay runner. He said, "You described what happened at a race, one of his first races, as someone had stumbled, the baton had been dropped and it was absolutely hopeless." Said, "But the baton came to our son and he took that baton and he began to run that fourth lap." He said, "All of a sudden, our son was running with a speed that we had never seen before, to the point that he began to gain ground. And it became so astonishing that even the other parents in the stands were rooting for this young man." He said, they told me, they said, "He crossed the finish line. We won. He won. He took the trophy. We were all standing down there so proud, and we finally had a few moments. We looked at our son and said, 'What happened to you?' He says, 'Well, my friend in that second lap that stumbled and fell,' he says, 'I just started thinking to myself, he deserves to win this race. He deserves it.' He says, 'So I ran so that my friend could have the trophy.'"
That puts a whole new level of perspective on this entire life experience. And Mike, I think that is a big reason why Hasatan wants to divide one generation from another and to rob us of our history.
Yeah. The story goes on that it happened again, another race. And the parents, you know, met down there and they said to their son, "Did you do this for your friend?" He says, "Oh, no." He says, I did it." He said, "I figured I did it once. I could do it a second time."
Yeah. Yeah. How about that? But we have to, first of all, get a handle on our identity and understand. This is the importance of the Hebraic identity, because it's bigger than Christian and it's bigger than Jewish. It is a connection to the life-giving covenant of the living Elohim, which cuts across all nations because he's opened it to all. Now, the custodians have been Jewish for a long, 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 long time. Others have come along that we call them Christian. And all have dropped the baton at one time or another, but they've also all had some astounding victories. The final victory is not complete if every generation does not do their part. And that's why when we go back and we talk about the Maccabees, I could talk as well about the Christian martyrs through the ages and say, without the sacrifices that they have made, we wouldn't be able to pick up the baton and run now. Mm-hmm. So what kind of race are we going to do? Well, first of all, let's get that identity settled down inside of us real deep, because once it's there, no one can snatch it away from us. And once it is there, let it inform our actions so that we begin to see ourselves as part of a greater team, the team of the Heavenly Father, rather than saying, "God is with us, God is on our side." Ask, well, who's on the Lord's side? Pray it's us. Because, you know, even the most ardent anti-missionary Jewish rabbis who have existed over the last several centuries are on the same team with the anti-Semitic reformers Martin Luther and John Calvin. How are we going to reconcile that?
There was some bad handoffs. There were some bad things that happened along the way. I'm not going to make excuses, but what I have to focus on is this. All that stuff is, at this moment in time, is not something that I'm going to argue or even most times enter into a discussion about. What I am going to say is this, that if this is a marathon or if this is a relay race, and I believe it is, and that we are on the fourth lap, which I believe we are, then the listeners, each person listening to me today or a podcast or whatever, you need to understand something, that the Heavenly Father has selected you. You are not so smart that you got, that you decided to be born right now. But the Father has selected you to be alive now in this generation for a purpose. And that means that He has called you to be a fourth lap person because He understands, He knows you better than you know yourself. And He sees that you are a fourth lap person. Start running like it.
Right.
So if you don't care to agree with some of your running mates, those that are on the team, when they hand you the baton, take it. Whether you like that person, agree with that person, admire that person or not, they're on your team. And in order for you to stand with the prize, you got to do your job to the best of your ability and not worry about how well they did or didn't do their job. That's out of our control. But what is in our control is how well we do what we're called to do.
Yeah. I can't control how someone else has run. And in fact, the book of Galatians talks about if you see a brother stumble. Now, there's a difference between stumbling and just, you know, and causing somebody to be and being a stumbling block. There's a total difference there. But if you see your brother stumble, it says, restore such a one in meekness, lest you also be tempted.
Okay.
So maybe the more that people desire to point their fingers at those who stumbled, that may be your own demise in your own stumble.
Mike, here we are just a couple minutes from the end of the program, but I'm going to go back to that illustration you shared of the young man who won that relay race for his team after his friend had dropped the baton. You know what we too often do? We would do what this young man did not do, to his credit. He didn't go over there and yell at his friend and say how stupid and clumsy you were to drop the baton and keep us from winning. You should have done this better. You know what? I think his friend understood where he made a mistake. Yeah. And I think his friend understood that the best he could do was just pick that baton up and keep running and pass it to the next runner. So I'm not going to criticize my segregationist ancestors, my anti-Semitic ancestors. I'm going to recognize they were doing the best they could and strive to do better.
Al, guess what?
What?
If that young man hadn't have stumbled, the young man that ran across the line and won the race, he would have never known that he had that in him.
That's right. That's right.
Things to ponder, guys, as we enter into this Hanukkah season. If somebody doesn't want to observe Hanukkah, hey, I'm fine with it. I'm okay. But don't tell me that I can't.
Right. Is that where we get to not judging one another for what day they keep?
It's. I guess you could get into that one a little bit, but I know this. We're gonna. This is what we're gonna do, and I'm not gonna get real angry about Christmas again this year, because as to quote Cole Davis, finding paganism in Babylon does not make you Dick Tracy.
Amen.
That's a classic line.
It is. It is. I love that. You know. Yeah. So you know, after Hanukkah's done. All those people are going to be saying, you know, wow, I'm stressed out because Christmas is coming. You say, well, next year, you ought to look at Hanukkah because it's not stressful. It's just fun. Latkes. Eat some latkes. Even sweet potato latkes, Barry Phillips.
You can have
if you don't like that, regular latkes with some garlic, onions, and green chilies.
Great on me. Who's rising up for all to see, but you did not know it, did ya? Well, you've seen it with your own two eyes, brother Judah is life.